Supplement 4, Cyclone B and Gas Detectors in Birkenau Crematorium 2. The main content of this supplement first appeared in print in the Journal of Historical Review, Volume 16, Number 5, September to October 1997, pages 24-30. Cyclone B. In the hoax of the 20th century, I remarked that typhus was a great killer for the Germans in World War I, giving a reference published shortly after that war. The typhus of World War I, like that of World War II, was carried by lice. In response to this specific problem, the German company Degesch, Deutsche Gesellschaft für Schädlingsbekämpfung, German Pest Control Company, developed the Cyclone B pesticide, and made it available for commercial use in 1923. Cyclone B, referred to here merely as Cyclone, is a very effective pesticide consisting of liquid hydrogen cyanide, HCN, an acid, absorbed into some inert material such as wood pulp, with an irritant added to warn bystanders of its presence. HCN is also called prussic acid and in German Blausäure, blue acid, because HCN tends to leave blue stains in the presence of iron compounds like rust. The resulting insoluble and non-toxic iron salt of HCN, iron blue, is commonly used in blue dyes. In its gaseous or liquid form, HCN is very deadly, and is used in American execution gas chambers, where it is traditionally generated by mixing an acid, normally sulfuric acid, with potassium cyanide or sodium cyanide, resulting in rapid release of HCN in its gaseous form. HCN is useless as a battlefield gas because it is a true gas, slightly lighter than air, and disperses too rapidly for that application. World War I battlefield gases were actually dust that hovered about the target area. The pesticide Cyclone works somewhat differently. It is supplied in a very tightly sealed container. When a space, for example a barracks or building, is to be treated with it, that space is tightly sealed, and trained personnel empty cans of Cyclone on the floor, preferably spreading that Cyclone out as much as possible. They then leave the space, close it, and wait the time required for the liquid HCN to pass into the gaseous form by evaporation, fill the space, and kill the target pests. Then the space is opened and ventilated. This is a very time-consuming process because the evaporation is slow, and for safety reasons the time required for ventilation is lengthy. The boiling point of HCN is 25.6 degrees Celsius, 78 degrees Fahrenheit. That does not mean the space must have that ambient temperature in order for the gas to be released. Water does not have to be brought to its boiling point in order to evaporate. However, the process is slow at any lower temperature, and especially slow in winter temperatures. An information booklet for Cyclone gives typical times of 2 to 72 hours for the gassing process, and at least 10 hours for ventilation. The former depends very much on the temperature and the target pests, and the latter on the physical properties of the space and its contents. For example, clothing and bedding should be beaten even after ventilation. Another step recommended at the end of a Cyclone gassing and ventilation process is the test for residual HCN gas. The typical test uses a mixture of copper acetate and benzidine acetate, and test paper which turns dark blue if the HCN level is dangerously high. A temperature of at least 15 degrees Celsius, 60 degrees Fahrenheit, is required to perform this test, so there are many circumstances under which it cannot be performed. Use of Cyclone is inherently dangerous, and during the war there existed a German regulation that it could be used only by, or under license from, Degesch, which was officially responsible for training all operators using it. There have also been gas chambers designed specifically to use Cyclone to disinfest articles, such as clothing, with HCN, especially in Germany. With few exceptions, the interiors of these gas chambers are heated, in order to accelerate the development of the gaseous HCN from the liquid form, and for other reasons. Gaseous HCN is water-soluble, so high temperature is desired to reduce moisture in the gas chamber. Also, lice and some other pests are easier to kill at higher temperatures, because their metabolism rates are higher. Desired temperatures are in the range 25 to 35 degrees Celsius, 77 to 95 degrees Fahrenheit. In such gas chambers, the air/gaseous HCN mixture is expelled from the top when the gassing process is completed, for safety reasons and perhaps because fresh air that enters during the ventilation is cool and the warmer air/HCN gas mixture tends to the top of the chamber. As already mentioned, gaseous HCN, by itself, is only slightly lighter than air. A related point is that the standard German Cyclone gas chamber of the time used a circulatory system developed by Degesch. In this system, the air/HCN mixture is continually recirculated, meaning it continually exits and re-enters the gas chamber. Circulation greatly reduces the length of time required to generate the gas from that Cyclone and work on the target pests. At the conclusion of the gassing, expulsion of the gas and the introduction of fresh air are accomplished by opening and closing the relevant ports in this circulatory system. Overall, a gas chamber with circulation is about 3 times more effective than one without, meaning can do about 3 times more work. The practical minimum time required to kill lice, among the most difficult and resistant creatures, with Tsuklone is about 3/4 of an hour. In a heated gas chamber with circulation, a total time of about 1 hour for gas generation and killing of the lice, followed by a ventilation period of about 20 minutes, is attainable under practical operational conditions. The best material for a gas chamber using HCN is steel. If bricks or concrete are used, then the interiors must be coated with a sealant to prevent retention of the gas in the walls of the gas chamber. Gas detectors. The extermination legend claims that the pesticide Tsuklone B was used to exterminate Jews in a gas chamber within Auschwitz Crematorium II at Birkenau, see figure 33 contained in the print and ebook editions of this book, specifically, in Leichenkeller 1, Morgue Cellar 1, whose alleged real purpose was concealed by being so designated. In his 1989 book, Pressick remarked on a telegram of February 26, 1943 from the Auschwitz Construction Department to the furnace maker Topf. At that date, the construction of Crematorium II was nearing completion. The telegram requested delivery of 10 gas detectors for Crematorium II, as had been earlier discussed. The specific gas to be detected was not stated, but by a process of tortured reasoning, Pressick concluded that the detectors were for HCN gas, rather than for, quote, the products of combustion, such as CO or CO2, in the furnace room, unquote, and classified this document as one of his so-called criminal traces. Robert Forsen wrote, in reply, that Pressick himself had solved this problem, and that there was no reason to believe the detectors were for HCN. Pressick did more research, and published a new book in 1993, in which he produced a document newly discovered in the recently opened Moscow archives. It is a letter dated March 2, 1943 from the Topf Company, by senior engineer Prüfer and a Topf colleague, to the Auschwitz Construction Department, and it shows that HCN was indeed the specific gas to be detected by the detectors. It reads, quote, we confirm receipt of your telegram specifying immediately send 10 gas detectors as agreed, price quote to follow. We hereby inform you that 2 weeks ago we inquired, of 5 different companies, concerning the residual HCN detection devices sought by you. We have received negative responses from 3 companies, and 2 have not yet answered. If, then, we receive information on this matter, we shall immediately contact you, in order to put you in touch with a company that makes these devices, unquote. Forreston's reply was that Tsuklone B was used for delousing operations throughout the camp and of course in Crematorium II. Naturally, HCN gas detectors would have been required in such operations, in which they are standard equipment. A problem. In both cases, Forreston gave the simple, obvious replies that I would have given under the circumstances. However, I believe this interpretation is wrong, for reasons that may be seen by examining the document. The main obstacle to interpreting this letter in terms of Tsuklone B is the roles of Topf and Prüfer. Tsuklone was a product of the Degesch company. Tsuklone and associated equipment such as gas detectors and gas mask filters were also manufactured by other companies such as Tesch and Stabenow and Dragerwerke. At Auschwitz, delousing operations with Tsuklone were such major and continuous tasks that there existed a special department, the Referat für Schädlingsbekämpfung, Pest Control Office, that conducted them. This department on occasion even communicated directly with Degesch. Topf was a furnace maker with crematorium ovens as a sideline, and was the principal civilian contractor in the construction of crematoria at Auschwitz. Prüfer was the main Topf contact of the Auschwitz construction department, and of course was not associated with the special SS delousing squads that regularly worked with Tsuklone B. Why should Prüfer have been searching, indeed with great difficulty, for devices that were standard equipment for the delousing squads and were readily available from the Degesch and other companies, which had developed and supplied Tsuklone? The standard Degesch detector for HCN required exposing a test paper, and observing the color assumed. The Prüfer letter even implies that he does not know whether the desired devices exist, was confronting this specific need for the first time, and does not know very much about it, inferences that are very important in interpreting the letter. I do not believe the letter had anything to do with Tsuklone. There may, however, have been one connection between Topf and Tsuklone. Robert Forreston has brought to my attention an anti-revisionist, Pressick-supporting book published in France in early 1997. A footnote declares, quote, the study of the history of the Topf and Sons Company of Erfurt would be essential to show the progression to mass crime. Topf made, in the 20s, crematoria but also grain silos. In the after-sale services and maintenance for these silos, Topf also involved itself in HCN disinfestation, and furnished all necessary material. Thus, the two branches of activity of the firm converge in a striking manner toward the crematoria gas chambers of Birkenau. On this particular sort of study, the works of Prusik are of the greatest utility, and it is in this way that they should be used. Unquote. The author gives no sources, but I think the claim of such Topf involvement with HCN, presumably via Zuclone, is quite plausible. Under conditions where Topf would have been the only company that a farmer dealt with in constructing his silo, it would have been natural for Topf to serve as retailer of supporting materials and equipment made by Degash and other companies. However, such a Topf role had no bearing on conditions at Auschwitz in 1941-1945, where a special department regularly conducted operations with Zuclone. Their personnel would have been responsible for declaring when a treated facility was again safe to use. Is it plausible that Prüfer could have been involved in this when, as his letter shows, he didn't know very much about it? There remains one possibility. Perhaps some unusual feature of the cremation process, not understood by the Zuclone delousing personnel, raised a novel problem with the Zuclone that Prüfer was asked to solve. I can't imagine such a feature, since cremation with coke seems basically like any other use of coke. However, if such an unusual feature existed, would it not have come up earlier in the 6-Muffel crematorium, also supplied by Topf, that existed in the Stammlager or Auschwitz one? In 1942, this sole crematorium was working at capacity, and the disastrous typhus epidemics were being fought with Zuclone. However, the February to March 1943 correspondence marked the first confrontation of Prüfer with the problem involved. Some novel feature of crematorium 2 had to be the problem. It is also clear that the letter has nothing to do with gas detectors as defenses against chemical warfare. The German chemical warfare services were highly competent and organized, and would not have sent a furnace maker on a quest for such equipment. From one point of view, the problem raised has little to do with the extermination allegations. If the Zuclone were being used to kill people, rather than lice, then presumably the same specially trained squads would have been used or at least consulted, and the usual HCN gas detectors would have been used in the last stages of gassing operations. There would have been no problems in acquiring such standard equipment. Those who believed Zuclone was used for homicidal purposes should be as puzzled by this document as I was. From another point of view, this problem is very relevant to the claim of extermination, as explained below. An alternative interpretation. The Topf letter of March 2, 1943 is strange, and for a while I suspected its authenticity. However, I have found an interpretation, which may be correct, and the main purpose of this article is to propose it. After I have done that, I shall return to the question of the relevance of this problem to the extermination allegations. HCN is of course a compound of hydrogen, carbon and nitrogen, and may be generated whenever materials containing these elements are burned. For example, the fuel used for the crematorium ovens was coke, and it is well known that HCN gas is a possible byproduct in the process of making coke from coal. However, there is apparently no danger of HCN release when coke, of whatever grade, is burned as a fuel, otherwise it would not be in such common use. HCN gas could not have been thus generated in the crematorium. A remaining possibility is that HCN release was possible in the waste incinerator, which shared the chimney with the cremation ovens. Many materials may release HCN when burned. Among these are many fabrics, a highly relevant observation, because the waste incinerator was most likely used to incinerate used camp fabrics, for example inmate uniforms and bed linen and mattresses. For example, silk and wool can release HCN when burned, a fact that has been known since the 30s. As shown in figure 34 contained in the print and ebook editions of this book, the chimney of crematorium 2 was divided into 3 ducts. 6 furnaces used this chimney, namely the waste incinerator and the 5 cremation furnaces, each with 3 muffles. The waste incinerator was on the opposite side of the chimney in relation to the cremation furnaces. These 6 furnaces used the 3 ducts on the basis of 2 per duct, thus, the waste incinerator shared one of the 3 ducts with one of the cremation furnaces. The flues leading from the furnaces to the chimney were underground. The waste incinerator was also supplied by Topf, and it could have been Prüfer's responsibility to take into account any HCN danger arising from it. Also, a gas detector differing from that used in the Zuclone delousing operations would seem fitting. Perhaps a detector generating an audible alarm was desired. While a concern for HCN release in combustion is routine today, it would have been novel in 1943, a fact that could explain the novelty for Prüfer of the desire for an HCN detector. Another thing that could account for this novelty is that the waste incinerator design was itself novel. I have no expertise in the field, but I would think intuitively that a waste incinerator design sharing a chimney with other equipment, at which people are working, is dangerous. The question of the quantities of HCN released in the burning of materials is complicated and depends on, quote, the chemical nature of the material, temperature, oxygen availability, and burning time, unquote. Since HCN is itself combustible, it makes a difference whether the combustion is static or dynamic, an example of the latter being when there is forced air blowing, and the HCN is swept away from the hot zone before it can itself be decomposed in any way. However, HCN can be released under either condition. Another complication is that HCN can be released in the smoldering after a fire has been extinguished. The term residual that appears in the letter in question could apply to either released HCN that, ideally, would have been consumed during the incineration process but wasn't, or to HCN released after incineration during smoldering. The chimney of Crematorium II used, as of January 29, 1943, a forced draft system based on suction, but on March 25, 1943, Topf ordered this system removed due to overheating of its motors. A specific possibility. It remains to suggest a specific potential source for HCN development in the waste incinerator. In wartime Germany, many articles had to be ersatz, artificial or synthetic, because of shortages of materials normally imported. Cotton was in very short supply, and little was used for fabrics. Wool was available but not in normal quantities. In fact, Germany relied heavily on the manufacture of rayon, and during the war, army uniforms contained as much as 65% rayon. One must assume concentration camp uniforms and other fabrics used in the camps had high rayon content. Could the incineration of such rayon have produced HCN gas? It may seem not, because rayon has no nitrogen in its chemical composition. In making these statements, I am using the word rayon in the normally accepted sense. Rayon is regenerated cellulose made from natural cellulose, extracted from materials such as cotton linters or wood pulp. Cotton was scarce in wartime Germany, so almost all rayon was made from wood pulp. The burning of rayon can generate HCN gas, if the rayon is impregnated with, but not chemically bound to, compounds of ammonia, which supply the necessary nitrogen. This was established some years ago by T. Morikawa, who conducted experiments that established that ammonia and its compounds, combined with cellulosic materials, can indeed result in the evolution of HCN when burned. The general conclusion was that such evolution was about the same as for substances having nitrogen in their chemical compositions in comparable amounts. It is of great relevance, for this discussion, that Morikawa's study of this point was motivated by the fact that ammonium compounds are added to many fabrics to make them flame retardant. This is sometimes called fireproofing, but that cannot be done literally with ordinary fabrics. Thus, Morikawa's experiments used, as the source of nitrogen, diammonium phosphate, a common flame retardant for fabrics. During World War II, diammonium phosphate was commonly used in Germany to make fabrics, particularly rayon, flame retardant. Two such products were marketed by IG Farben under the trade names Acoustan N and Acoustan N1139. Another product, Acoustan K, used other ammonium compounds as the flame retardant. A disadvantage of such flame retardants is that they are water-soluble and gradually leach out when the fabrics are washed. Thus, such soluble flame retardants, quote, are applied with the idea of periodic reprocessing in order to maintain the desired properties by simple immersion in aqueous solutions, unquote, of the retardant. That is, washing is followed by immersion in a solution of the flame retardant substance, then drying out. Another defense against leaching, employed by the Germans, used sulfamide, strictly speaking sulfuralamide, SO2NH22, in conjunction with a standard waterproofing agent, thus making reprocessing unnecessary. Sulfamide is obtained by treating sulfuryl chloride with ammonia, and one gets the impression from Morikawa that one could also expect evolution of HCN and burning of cellulose impregnated with it. While I do not have a document that says so, I consider it very plausible that many concentration camp fabrics were treated with flame retardants for security reasons, meaning to limit the effects of fires started by inmates. This would have been particularly the case with bed linens and mattress fillings. Thus, I am proposing the possibility that fabrics used in the camps, destined to be disposed of by incineration, were known to present a danger of evolution of HCN in such incineration. The favored German process for rayon manufacture was the viscose, which is also the favored process today. However, two German factories used the older and simpler cupramonium process. That the cupramonium process involved a solution of ammonia does not appear relevant to the present problem. What may be relevant is that a price of its simplicity was that the cupramonium process required celluloses of a high degree of purity. Thus, cotton linters were considered the standard cellulose source for cupramonium rayon, but on account of wartime shortages, the two German cupramonium factories used wood pulp instead. This resulted in an inferior quality rayon. Much of the cupramonium rayon was used for army uniforms, but there were other uses, for example military upholstery, mattress fillings, and parachutes. I have no source saying that it was used in concentration camp fabrics, but in view of its inferior quality, this is a very admissible conjecture. One version of the cupramonium rayon used for mattress fillings was impregnated with urea and formaldehyde, with ammonium nitrate as a catalyst, in order to impart springiness to it. It is known that urea can cause some ammonium-based flame retardants to react with cellulose, thus giving a fabric so treated resistance to leaching. Summary. In summary, I am saying, it is certain the top letter has nothing to do with Soclone. It is almost certain that the HCN danger referred to arose from the waste incinerator. I would be astonished if it were shown that such was not the case. It is probable that the HCN detectors were wanted because of a potential danger of HCN development in the incineration of fabrics, particularly rayons treated with flame retardants. However, I am far from certain on this, and I will not be astonished if other materials consumed in the waste incinerator were shown to have been suspected by the Auschwitz management as potential sources of HCN development. Observations. Above, I promise to return to the question of the relevance of the problem treated here to the extermination allegations. The mass of documents shows that Auschwitz was a large concentration camp with a disastrous death rate, due mainly to typhus carried by lice. In response to such problems, the Germans made great use of the pesticide Cyclone B, and constructed large crematoria. There are no records showing that Jews were gassed or exterminated. That is clear, and it ought not be necessary to argue that such was not the case. The documentation is immense, and the physical facts concerning the camp are conclusive. For more detail, see the remarks I delivered at the 1992 IHR Convention, on the death rates and the crematoria capacities at Auschwitz and other camps. Another approach uses the normal historical method: you study what the people of the time were doing. I have discussed elsewhere the trap that the historian Walter LeCour got himself into by applying this normal historical method to Auschwitz. For a more general and introductory discussion, see Forreson's tutorial. For practical purposes, the entire extermination legend rests on the claim that Auschwitz was an extermination camp where about 1 million Jews were gassed with Cyclone B, in otherwise designated rooms within the crematorium buildings. Since that is emphatically not what the historical record says, the promoters of the legend are highly selective in choosing documents, which Pressick calls criminal traces, which, it is claimed, prove their thesis. The HCN gas detectors are one of the criminal traces on Pressick's pathetically short list. In historiography, there is an alternative and more commonplace description of Pressick's procedure with criminal traces. It is bad historiography of the simplest sort, tendentious selection of a very small part of the data, resulting in grossly distorted history. Normally, one cannot get away with this. But today, a Pressick, waving aside historical reasoning and the mountain of documentary evidence, comes rushing forward waving some document and saying, in effect, "But how about this?" And he is respected instead of being ignored or laughed at. He is credited by some with finally proving the extermination allegation as it relates to Auschwitz, although it had for years been claimed that it had been proven, and that there was nothing to argue about. Thus, to the person who objects that I have treated petty details here, which are incommensurate with the scale of the historical claim involved, I reply, you are right, but it isn't my fault. Ordinary historical reasoning observes that nobody acted, during the war, as though extermination was going on, and that the Jews were still there at war's end. However, a lot of influential people won't accept ordinary historical reasoning, and the debate, to the extent that it exists, has revolved around the petty details. The promoters of the legend may get away with such practices for a while in arguing the reality of physical exterminations of Jews during World War II. There are two leading reasons for this. Most obvious is the fact of the entrenched status of the legend. What ought to require proof has been allowed to flourish unproved, and the revisionists have in effect been forced to try to argue a negative. Another reason, less obvious but very simple, is that the revisionists may not be able to immediately offer correct replies to the sallies of the defenders of the legend. This appears to me to have been the case with the top letter. I don't believe Forreson's immediate replies, which I would also have made, were correct. In fact, nobody could be relied on to be correct under the circumstances and in the time frame involved. A comparison, there is much building activity at Northwestern University now. Does anybody believe that, 50 years from now, perhaps after some cataclysm, anybody could reliably interpret individual documents that were records of this construction? Of course not. Nobody could do that, and nobody could infallibly interpret every Auschwitz document from the period 1941 to 1945. Indeed, the hypothesis I have advanced here may be wrong, even though I have had a few years to consider the solitary document in question. Some years ago, I warned of these dangers. It is not out of the question that, someday, an authentic Auschwitz document might utterly confound the revisionists, meaning raise some apparently relevant question of detail which they will be unable to answer. I can only urge that the context, that is, the massive documentation and historical circumstance supporting the revisionist position, be kept in mind in the event of such a development. Reply to Carlo Matonio and the editor on the gas detectors. I wish to reply to Carlo Matonio's articles on gas detectors for the crematorium at Auschwitz, and the editor's prologue to those articles. In 1998, Matonio and I wanted to air this issue in the Journal of Historical Review, but the editor declined to carry the exchange. I am grateful for this opportunity to do so. I shall assume the reader has studied the issue, not only in the aforementioned article, but also, and especially, in my original article, and in Matonio's rebuttal of it. The problem. In the correspondence relating to the construction of Crematorium II, the Central Construction Office telegraphed the furnace and crematorium oven maker Topf, on February 26, 1943, as follows, quote, "Send off immediately 10 gas testers, Gasprüfer, as discussed. Hand in estimate later," unquote. Topf's reply was sent on 2nd of March and reads as follows, quote, "Erfurt, March 2, 1943. Regarding, Crematory, 2, gas testers. We confirm the receipt of your telegram, saying, send off immediately 10 gas testers as discussed. Hand in estimate later. In this regard, we inform you that already 2 weeks ago we asked 5 different firms about the display devices for hydrogen cyanide residue, Anzeigergeräte für Blausäurereste, requested by you. We received negative answers from 3 firms, and from 2 others, an answer is still outstanding. In case we receive notification in this matter, we shall get close to you immediately so that you can get in contact with the firm producing these devices," unquote. In Matonio's present paper and its prologue, there are 3 translations of Anzeigergeräte, namely display devices, pages 140, 150, indicators, page 141, and gauges, captioned to figure 3-6, page 148. I have used the first here, though I used detection devices in my original paper. Note that there is a substantial distinction, since the terms display devices and gauges suggest continuous measurement, while indicators and detection devices suggest activation only at some critical threshold. I want to especially note a feature of this letter that is as important as the reference to HCN, hydrogen cyanide. It expresses a failure to find a supplier of the desired devices. Matonio expressed this as, quote, "Topf's difficulty in locating them," unquote. However, Matonio effectively ignored this feature of the document, both in formulating his theory and in critiquing my theory. A second fault of his critique is that he inexplicably ignored a point that I took some pains to present clearly. Matonio's proposed solution and its problems. Matonio's style is prolix, possibly because he has available a wealth of documents, and one must read long and carefully to discern his main thesis. It is this: the document as it comes to us makes no sense because it would have us believe that the furnace maker Topf was asked by the Central Construction Office to supply detectors of, or testers for, residual HCN from use of the pesticide Cyclone. That is the wrong department at Auschwitz going to the wrong source. This is so implausible that Matonio believes that the document is a forgery, produced by taking an original document and substituting alternative words. Thus he would substitute Rauchgasanalyse, flue gas analysis, for Blausäurereste to have the document make sense. His grounds are, that for Topf a concern for flue gas was routine, and thus simple flue gas analyzers, as he puts it, for CO or other familiar gases must have been in question. Matonio's analysis is masterful as regards that Cyclone, but nowhere in the present paper does he consider the possibility of a source of HCN other than Cyclone. Of course, we cannot believe the document in his interpretation, for the reasons he gives. However, by altering the document so that Topf is trying to fill a routine need, he worsens the situation because the document says the opposite. It says that what was being sought was not routine for Topf. It is wildly illogical to argue that we must replace a reference to an unusual need with a reference to a routine need when the document says it was unusual. While it is indeed not credible that Topf was asked to supply detectors of HCN generated by Cyclone, it is even more incredible that Topf said, as Matonio would have us believe, that it can't fill an order for, or even figure out a source of, simple flue gas analyzers for carbon monoxide, CO, or other common products of combustion. Topf would have had no trouble finding such things. I should add that even if, despite all the considerations Matonio has adduced, Topf had been asked to supply detectors for HCN as a product of Cyclone, then Topf would have been able to figure out how or where to get them, despite the matter being outside its field. Matonio claims that, if we make the substitution he proposes, then, quote, "all problems discussed above disappear instantaneously," unquote. The problems disappear because he has replaced them with a new, insoluble problem. He has thrown the baby out with the bathwater. The document makes less sense if we make Matonio's substitution. For the forgery thesis to work, the whole received document must be thrown out. I can't see any grounds for that, and Matonio has not found such grounds. An alternative solution. My hypothesis is that the Central Construction Office asked TOPF to supply detectors of HCN as a combustion product, a hazard that in 1943 had been known for only about a decade. On the last point, I could have given more dates and documentation. The already cited 1977 paper by White Tsuchiya gives the historical background, at least for the USA. After a great loss of life in the Cleveland Clinic fire due to fumes from burning X-ray films, J.C. Olson conducted laboratory investigations that determined amounts of HCN generated by the incineration of nitrocellulose film, wool and silk, and reported the results in papers published in 1930 and 1933. In this regard, I should note an error I made when I wrote, quote, "Nylon and wool can release HCN when burned, a fact that has been known since the 30s, unquote. I should have written silk and wool. Nylon was not cited in the literature, apparently, until 1962. The HCN detectors used with Soclone would have been useless for the detection of HCN as a product of continuing combustion, because as Matonio explained, they were chemical kits designed to be used at specific times, meaning, immediately after disinfestations with Soclone. If residual HCN as a combustion product was a concern in the crematorium/waste incinerator installation, then continuous monitoring of some sort would have been desired. Matonio agrees that in context, the TOPF letter suggests a device for such continuous monitoring. TOPF's failure to find a source of the detectors must be taken into account in interpreting some of the things I wrote earlier. My style is terse, and this perhaps leads to misunderstandings. For example, Matonio ridiculed my suggestion that, quote, "perhaps a detector of HCN generating an audible alarm was desired," unquote, on the grounds that such devices did not exist. But that would explain perfectly why they weren't found. I never said they existed. I have surmised that in 1943, a concern for HCN as a combustion product was relatively novel, and practicing engineers could have been somewhat uncertain on how, or what was available to deal with it. Another point I have emphasized in this controversy is the odd design of the crematorium II chimney. I attempted to clearly lay this out in my original article, via the reproduction of an engineering drawing of the flues and ducts for the crematorium. In order to make this clear, I again refer to this drawing, figure 34 in the appendix. The duct running between the waste incinerator, the Mollverbrennungsofen that appears as the uppermost part of the installation, and one of the cremation ovens is clearly visible on the right side of the drawing. The chimney stands between the waste incinerator and the five cremation ovens, and a common duct conducts the effluents of the waste incinerator and the rightmost of the five ovens to the chimney. When I said that the design of the waste incinerator was novel, I meant with respect to the chimney flues, I didn't mean the combustion chamber was novel. Matonio ignored this crucial point and argued that, for my suggestion to work, the flue gases of the waste incinerator would have to exit the chimney at a height of 16 meters, and then somehow make their way back into the crematorium. That is impossible. I argued, or at least I clearly implied, that the odd design of the chimney flues raised the danger of HCN reaching the crematorium ovens and furnace room directly from the waste incinerator. Science and engineering practice. Another feature of Matonio's critique is that he assumes an overly simplistic model for the transmission and application of scientific developments. For example, he argues on the one hand that a concern for HCN as a combustion product could not have been novel in 1943, if scientific investigations established the danger in papers published a decade earlier. He also argues that an effect involving burning rayon with impregnated flame retardants could not have been known by the Germans in 1943, because the first scientific paper on the effect in question was published in 1978. In fact, it can, on the one hand, take years for a fact established in a laboratory to be taken into account by practicing engineers, especially when the design and manufacture of special devices are required. On the other hand, certain facts may be available to the practicing engineers long before a formal paper is published laying them out. Scientific publication is closely related to PhD dissertations, and I can testify that I have examined many such dissertations which were worthy in relation to what had already been formally published, but which I knew must have been surpassed by work not published for reasons of either national security, classified work with military or intelligence applications, or commercial proprietorship, or just preoccupation with practice over publication. In fact, it can be very difficult to discern, from the outside, what engineers practicing in a given area, at a given time, knew or believed. Even the initial recognition of HCN as a combustion product is somewhat cloudy, as the earliest source that White Tsuchiya cites is an anonymous report in a 1929 engineering journal. Even he does not know to whom the initial apprehension should be credited, and there is no proof that somebody didn't know it before 1929. White Tsuchiya, incidentally, lists no pre-war German sources, but there must have been some. Conclusion. I think 1943 was about the right time for practicing German engineers to have been concerned with, but not quite sure what to do about, HCN as a combustion product. My theory depends on this idea that the authors of the correspondence were not sure what they should do, but I have not postulated the uncertainty to shore up my theory. It is in the document in question, even the part of the document that Matonio would retain. All I am suggesting is that the reason the Central Construction Office turned to a furnace maker for HCN detectors was that what was involved was a concern for HCN as a combustion product, not a pesticide. I am bewildered that such a simple interpretation of the document in question should meet such resistance. Copyright September 21, 2004. Editor's remark. Both Arthur Butz and Carlo Matonio have ignored a very early critique of the Topf letter of March 2, 1943, authored by Austrian civil engineer Walter Luftl. It was first published in 1994 in Luftl's contribution to the anthology Grundlagen zur Zeitgeschichte, using the pen name Werner Rademacher, and later translated in various English editions of this book. Most of the observations made by Luftl were also pointed out by Matonio and Butz, although some were evidently overlooked. I take this opportunity to bring Luftl's missed arguments back into focus, and I add a few more observations. Formal assessment. Part 2 of Matonio and Deanna's three-part study on the cremation furnaces of Auschwitz, subsequently abbreviated as MD, contains many reproductions of letters, estimates and invoices issued by the Topf company prior to and during World War II. Other works by Matonio contain several more such document reproductions. From analyzing these documents and comparing them to the Topf letter in question, subsequently abbreviated as TL, the following observations are worth noting. 1. The letterhead of TL states in the subtitle line beneath J.A. Topf und Zuna, Maschinenfabrik Stern Feuerungstechnische Bauunternehmung. This line has a gray bar on top and below. Most other documents originating from Topf either simply state Maschinenfabrik or Maschinenfabrik und Feuerungstechnisches Baugeschäft. I found only two examples using Maschinenfabrik Stern Feuerungstechnische Bauunternehmung, both of 1943, MD 338, 357. None of the known letterheads have gray bars on top and below the subtitle. 2. Topf stationery had its address field delimited by four angle brackets, making sure that the typist places the address correctly. TL does not have this. 3. The address is typed too high on TL, with the first line almost running into the lower gray bar of the subtitle. 4. All known letterheads list on the top right side the company's contact and payment details, telegram, phone, bank accounts, P.O. box and street address, CMD 265, 274, 277, 300, 316, 319, 325, 331, 389, 411, 413, 468. TL has only the company's P.O. box given, but no street address. All other details are in the document's footer, with two of them worded differently. TL, Telegrama, Topfwerke, rather than Drotvort, Topfwerk Erfurt, this incomplete address could have led to telegrams not reaching their destination. TL, Fernsprecher, Zammelnummer 25125, rather than Fernruf 25125. 5. The P.O. box is given on all letterheads as Postfach 552/8, with the digit 8 lowered. On TL, the line with the P.O. box number is partially obstructed by the stamp placed on top of it, but it is clear that no digit has been lowered. The number probably is 552/8, without the 8 lowered. 6. TL is signed, P.P.A. Sander. IV Proofer. Sander was Proofer's boss. P.P.A. equals per procura, indicates that this person signing is acting as the company's representative with far-reaching powers, while IV equals in Vertretung, in substitution, means that the signer signs on behalf of another person, usually a superior. However, this letter is signed by Proofer's boss, hence Proofer was not signing in Vertretung at all. This signing by an authorized officer of the company and by Proofer is an overkill for a mere response to a brief telegram. Linguistic assessment. All of Topf's wartime correspondence shows the proper use of the German special character est set where needed. In TL, we read das rather than the correct das with an est set. TL states, quote, Wenn wir in dieser Angelegenheit Mitteilung erhalten, kommen wir Ihnen sofort näher, unquote, which translates to, quote, when we receive notification in this matter, we shall get closer to you immediately, unquote. If this sounds awkward in English, it is even more awkward in German. The proper English expression would be, we shall approach slash contact slash get in touch with you immediately. The proper German would be, werden wir sofort auf Sie zukommen. Näher kommen cannot be used in the German language to denote a person trying to get in touch with someone. This points to the author of these lines not being a native German speaker, who has translated a similar expression from his own language, such as the English verb to approach, which can mean both to get in touch with someone, and to get physically closer to someone. This verb can be translated to the German verb näher kommen. However, näher kommen can only be used to denote approaches in terms of spatial or numerical distance, not in terms of getting in touch. Assessment of contents. There is a strange disconnect between the terse telegram by the Central Construction Office, and TOPF's alleged response to it with a lengthy letter. The telegram refers to a previous discussion between TOPF, probably TOPF's cremation expert Kurt Prüfer, and an Auschwitz official, probably the camp's heating technician Rudolf Yerling. The telegram expresses the expectation that TOPF could and would, quote, send off immediately 10 gas detectors as discussed, unquote. In other words, Prüfer left Yerling with the impression during their discussion that those devices were readily available and could be shipped instantly. It is rather unlikely that Prüfer would have given that impression if both men had discussed a novel problem, for which they did not yet know the solution. However, that is exactly the impression which TL gives. It is perfectly conceivable that the mounting of flue gas analyzers, gas detectors, in the flues of cremation furnaces which were just getting fired up, Crematorium 2, late February/early March 1943, was an urgent matter to be addressed immediately. However, it seems rather unlikely that the obscure possibility of some HCN developing inside the waste incinerator, which was also merely finished around that time, hence can hardly have been used by that time, would have induced the Central Construction Office to hurriedly procure completely unknown devices. Furthermore, TOPF was expected to ship the devices right away, and submit a cost estimate later. This was in violation of procedural regulations requiring the Central Construction Office to request estimates from various companies, before being allowed to place an order. While such a procedure for known devices of marginal costs is conceivable, this is not the case for unknown devices of unknown manufacturers and unknown prices. In such a case, it would have been particularly prudent to insist on cost estimates before placing an order, let alone having them shipped. In stark contrast to the telegram, TL indicates that TOPF would neither submit a cost estimate nor ship anything at all. TL suggests instead that TOPF was only trying to locate a potential manufacturer, then convey their contact information to the Central Construction Office, so they, quote, can get in contact with the firm producing these devices, unquote. In other words, these two documents very evidently deal with completely different events and our expectations. TL's reference to the telegram appears forced and out of place. Short of a complete forgery of TL, this can be explained only by a major misunderstanding between what the Central Construction Office expected of TOPF, and what TOPF was doing. No follow-up correspondence has been found in this regard, neither the requested cost estimate, nor the promised getting closer to convey manufacturer contact information. Conclusion. TL is a highly suspicious document. Only a forensic analysis of the original can give more clues as to whether it is a forgery or not.